You're listening to The Star Spot, episode 32 for Friday, June 14th, 2013.
I'm Justin Trottier, and I'll be your host at The Star Spot. The Star Spot is a space-themed podcast that focuses on all aspects of astronomy and space exploration. Episodes feature interviews with guests of wide-ranging backgrounds: scientists, engineers, educators, artists, politicians, and business people. Topics are similarly broad, from the latest space mission to how the universe began, from why humans explore to how we can make exploration economical. We'll also include a segment called Current in Space, bringing you reports on news and developments that may interest the space enthusiast. You can now find The Star Spot on Facebook at facebook.com/thestarspot and follow the show on Twitter at The Star Spot. Astronomy and science popularizer Carl Sagan famously declared, "We are all star stuff." He was referring, of course, to the discovery that much of the heavier elements in our bodies formed in the supernovas of dying stars. But after supernovas eject material out into the galaxy, how does that gas, and the rest of the interstellar medium, form into new stars and planets and, ultimately, us? To help answer that question, I'm joined at the Star Spot by astrophysicist Christopher McKee. But first, here's what's current in space.
A Chinese spacecraft has blasted off today on a 15-day mission to an experimental space lab in the latest step towards the development of a Chinese space station. This week, the Shenzhou 10 spacecraft was launched from a remote site in the Gobi Desert in China's far west. Traveling through warm, clear blue skies, the craft broadcast images carried live on state television. Once in orbit, Shenzhou will dock with the Tiangong-1, or in English, Heavenly Palace, a trial space laboratory module. The two male and one female astronauts will carry out various experiments and test the module's systems. They will also give a lecture to students back on Earth. China successfully carried out its first manned docking exercise with Tiangong-1 last June, a milestone in an effort to acquire the technological and logistical skills to run a full space station that can house people for long periods. This mission will be the longest duration Chinese astronauts have spent in space and marks the second mission for its lead astronaut. Since 2003, China has undertaken 5 manned space missions. As with previous expeditions, this one was accompanied by the usual outpouring of national pride and Communist Party propaganda, including children waving goodbye to the 3 astronauts at the Space Center. China's space program has come a long way since late leader Mao Zedong, founder of Communist China in 1949, lamented that the country could not even launch a potato into space. But China is still far from catching up with the established space superpowers, namely the United States and Russia. Rendezvous and docking techniques such as those which China is only testing now were mastered by the United States and the former Soviet Union decades ago. The 10.5-meter-long Tiangong-1 is a trial module, not a full-fledged space station. Still, the Shenzhou 10 mission will be the latest show of China's growing prowess in space and comes against American budget restraints and shifting priorities that have held back U.S. manned space launches. China is also planning an unmanned lunar landing and deployment of a moon rover. Scientists have raised the possibility of sending a man to the moon, though not before 2020.
Planetary Resources has high hopes. With their goal of expanding Earth's natural resource base, Planetary Resources has their gaze fixed on the prospect of one day mining asteroids. The American company's first step along that road features the deployment of small, inexpensive space telescopes. Planetary Resources recently launched a campaign on Kickstarter in support of the ARCID, the world's first crowdfunded space telescope accessible to the public. This week, the company has announced that if the total amount pledged exceeds $2 million in the 19 days remaining in the campaign, it will invest the additional funds to enhance the ARCID space telescope technology to enable it to search for alien planets. These upgrades would add exoplanet transit detection capability by enhancing the telescope's stability systems and dedicating time to monitor candidate star systems. A special bonus is that this upgrade would also allow for better measurement of the spin properties of asteroids using the same technique. Chris Lewicki, president and chief engineer of Planetary Resources, explained that, quote, "While the ARCID won't rival NASA's $600 million Kepler spacecraft, which may have to end its mission due to a recent equipment failure, the enhanced ARCID will be a huge step toward important new scientific discoveries enabled by citizen scientists, end quote. The company is partnered with one of the world's leading exoplanet scientists, Sarah Seeger. Dr. Seeger, professor of physics and planetary science at MIT, stated, quote, "We're excited about this game-changing approach that could transform how we do science in the future. It's not just about advanced technology in a small satellite, but a crowd-funded approach to space science that could be revolutionary. The enhanced version of the ARCID telescope will be an important source of data for exoplanets that can only be obtained from space, above the blurring effects of Earth's turbulent atmosphere," end quote. Dr. Seeger was also on episode 24 of The Star Spot, Atmospheres and Signs of Life on Planets Beyond Our Solar System. And adding to the company's star power is Peter Diamandis, co-founder of the International Space University, founder of Students for the Exploration and Development of Space, SEDS, and now co-chairman of Planetary Resources. Diamandis has expressed his passion for creating meaningful crowd involvement in this and related space projects. To date, more than 9,800 people from around the globe have become backers of the ARCID, while their Kickstart campaign has raised almost $900,000 towards their lofty $1 million goal. And that's what's current in space. Astrophysicist Christopher McKee is professor of physics and astronomy at the University of California, Berkeley, where he co-founded the Theoretical Astrophysics Center. He has had appointments at Caltech, Harvard, and the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. McKee is a member of the National Academy of Sciences and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He is an authority on the interstellar medium, the environment of sparse gas that exists between the stars of our galaxy. I want to welcome to the Star Spot, Professor Christopher McKee. Thank you so much for joining us here.
It's a pleasure to do that.
Professor McKee, before we get into the technical areas of your expertise, I wonder if you can first tell me a bit about what your early influences were in terms of pushing you towards an academic career in general, and then maybe more into the sciences in particular.
Well, I knew that I wanted to be a scientist ever since I was fairly young. That may have been partly stimulated by reading science fiction books. But I was also always very curious. And initially I was going to be a doctor. But then I decided that being a doctor would get kind of, you'd be seeing patients the same every day. I wanted to do something different. So then I thought I'd go into medical research. But then as I, through my teenage years, I gradually evolved toward getting interested in physics. And so I was a major in physics as an undergraduate, and then got my PhD in physics here at the University of California at Berkeley.
Was there any events in particular, any experiences you had that pushed you specifically into the astrophysics domain?
Yes, I had the opportunity to work with one of the most innovative astrophysicists in the world, a person named Sterling Colgate. I had a summer job at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, and after 1 year of graduate school, and he gave me a problem that he did not know the answer to, and I went around and asked other leading physicists at the laboratory to give me some help, and they didn't know the answer to the problem either. And it was the first time that I'd ever confronted real research in which nobody, even the experts in the field, really didn't know what the answer was. And after that, I was hooked.
Gotcha. You also mentioned in some of the interviews I've seen you give that accepting the Hertz Fellowship, maybe that's related, maybe that's unrelated to the story you were just saying, that also was a particularly defining moment in your life. Can you tell me a little bit about the Hertz Fellowship and why that experience was so important to you?
Certainly. The Hertz Fellowship was established by the Hertz, who established the rental car company, and it provided scholarship support for people who were interested in science. The focus of their scholarship was actually people interested in applied science. At that time, I was, in my career, it turned out I never did get very involved in applied science. Nonetheless, at the time that I received the Hertz Fellowship, I had been admitted to graduate school at UC Berkeley, but I had been intending to defer for a year and spend a year abroad. But once I received the fellowship, I immediately decided that I would, instead of going abroad for a year, I would go directly to graduate school. And that was sort of a crucial point in my life where, you know, had it gone the other direction, I have no idea what my future life would have been. But then, as I said, once I came to Berkeley, the Hertz Fellowship was connected with people at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. In particular, Edward Teller was one of the main individuals on the advisory board. And that, as I mentioned, gave me the opportunity to work out there during the first two summers that I was here. And in the second summer, I had the opportunity to work with Sterling Colgate, who then led me into this research.
I want to pick up on something you were just saying about being, you know, less inclined towards the applied side of the sciences. And I'm curious if you can explain to me the experimental versus the theoretical or the conceptual, those two different approaches. I mean, is it then the case that you're more into the latter, into the theoretical side of things?
Well, it is certainly true that I'm more into the theoretical side. In terms of the applied side, the Hertz Fellowship Program was particularly interested in getting people to take basic physics and chemistry knowledge and apply it to real-world problems. In a sense, astrophysics is the application of fundamental physics to the universe at large. But it's my understanding that that was not the primary focus of the Hertz Fellowship. The at the time that I went into physics, there did tend to be a division between experimental and theoretical physics. And then there were only a few people who would work in both areas. In astronomy, there's a third field, which is third aspect, which is observation. So you actually have people who build the instruments and develop new instruments, and those are the equivalent of the experimentalists. And they often, of course, the people who build the instruments then go ahead and use them. That's actually first they build the experiment and then they carry it out. Observers tend to use instruments that other people have already built, and theorists then are the same. As things have evolved, we've also now, and this has become particularly important in astrophysics, and it's also very important in particle physics. You have people who analyze the data that observers and experimentalists acquire. The data is so complicated that it becomes extremely challenging to analyze it and understand, and then understand what it means. And there's been a further proliferation in the development of simulation. So computers now enable us to actually simulate what is going on in nature. And astrophysics is often extremely complicated. There are many different physical processes at work in the same astronomical phenomenon. In doing theoretical work, you tend to pick out one or two of the dominant processes. Right. In doing simulations, you can attempt to include all the processes simultaneously, and then you have to go ahead and analyze the output of the simulation and try to understand what the significance of the simulation is. But even though computers have become enormously more powerful and they're continuing to get more powerful with each passing year, it's still the case that we're unable to fully simulate what goes on in nature. And the problem that I'm particularly interested in now is in the problem of star formation. And to form an individual star, you might start off with a region which is a million times the size of the solar system, and then have that gas gradually condense and get to be more and more dense, smaller and smaller, and eventually form a star. And the sun is actually, the radius of the sun is only 1/200th of the radius of the Earth's orbit. And the radius of the Earth's orbit is about only a couple of percent of the size of the solar system. So we have just many, many orders of magnitude in size. The initial time scale could be millions of years in the interstellar medium. The characteristic time scale for oscillations in the sun is 5 minutes. So you have an enormous range of timescales also. And at the present time, computers are unable to simultaneously handle that enormous dynamic range in space and in time. So we have to pick out some range of spatial scales and some range of temporal scales in order to simulate what goes on. Similarly, the number of physical processes is extremely large, so we tend to focus on what we think are the most important ones. Initially, people just had hydrodynamics, that is the flow of the gas and the effects of the gravity of the gas. And more recently, it's been possible to include the effects of the radiation emitted by the central star and to include the effects of magnetic fields. And then once you include the effects of the radiation, there's different kinds of radiation, so you can try to include that. And it's just a fascinating process that we're in the middle of now.
So astrophysics, if I understand, is kind of at the intersection of those three or maybe four areas: observation, theory, experiment, and more computer simulation.
That's correct.
I wanted to turn now to some of your work analyzing and theorizing about the interstellar medium and stellar formation. And in particular, I'm reminded of a quote from Carl Sagan. I guess others have said it in a similar way, that we're all made of star stuff. You know, we're all made of heavy elements that have been, in many cases, cooked in supernovas, in the death throes of dying stars, and that material is seeded out into the galaxy. And I always wondered, sort of, how does that material, once it's dispersed, now how does it find its way into second or third generation stars and their planetary bodies that surround them, and, you know, into us and potentially other life out there? How does that process work?
Well, that's actually a problem that's a subject of a lot of current research. So we know that the material inside the star that is cooked, as you say, so for example, if we just look at the sun, the sun is not making any heavy elements. It is converting hydrogen into helium, which is somewhat heavier than hydrogen. You get to stars that are more massive than the sun, however, then they can actually go ahead and convert the ordinary hydrogen, helium, into the elements such as carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and then heavier elements like iron, and then even heavier ones like lead. It is also true that some low-mass stars can do this. If you have a star that, for example, when the sun eventually will shed its outer envelope and become a white dwarf, which will be really physically in size only about the same size as the Earth. Now, the sun is a star all by itself. If it were in a binary star system, then it is possible that its companion, might turn into a white dwarf. The two white dwarfs might merge. They would then become too large to actually support themselves against gravity if you had the two stars together, and they would explode as a supernova. Huh. Another possible way in which this a star the size of the sun could explode as a supernova is if the companion that it had went through the red giant phase, which is when it expands out to large size prior to becoming a white dwarf, then that some of that envelope from the red giant could fall on to the white dwarf, again, pushing it over this maximum possible mass that it can manage to resist gravity. It would then collapse, and that would then induce an explosion, and you then send the heavy elements out into the interstellar medium. Once these elements are in the interstellar medium, it is not understood exactly how they get dispersed. An interesting question is, the elements, when they are created, are at extremely high temperature, much hotter even than at the center of the sun, so perhaps even a billion degrees in temperature.
Wow.
During the explosion, there's an enormous expansion, and expanding gases tend to cool off, so this very hot gas of heavy atoms becomes much colder, and we recently have obtained evidence that a lot of the heavier elements in this explosion will actually condense into very tiny dust grains, small particles that might only be a few nanometers in size. Hmm. And the question then is, what happens to those tiny little dust particles? They're expanding out at thousands of kilometers per second, perhaps 1% of the speed of light, but they have to slow down. So if they can slow down gently, then they could survive. On the other hand, most theoretical calculations suggest that they will go through a very powerful shockwave, which will then slow them down. And it's possible that during that process, the grains will be destroyed again. We really don't know what's going to happen. So we don't know whether these heavy elements are injected into the interstellar medium in solid form or in gaseous form. Then once these elements get into the interstellar medium, there's a question of how efficiently are the elements mixed in with the rest of the gas. And that is also being actively studied. Then the gas flows around, and in some cases you get into regions in which there's enough gas so that the self-gravity of the gas can start to cause the gas to collapse under the effect of its own self-gravity. And that's the process of star formation. And that then leads to a fascinating series of events. You have the overall collapse, but there's some rotation. And as a result, some of the gas does not fall directly into the forming star, but instead forms a disk around the star. And it's believed that out of this disk, you then form larger objects, namely the planets, such as in the solar system. And now more recently, we've discovered planets around hundreds of other stars as well.
You're one of the creators of what's called the three-phase model of the interstellar medium. Before we get into what that's all about, can you explain to me first what theory or what concept preceded the three-phase model for explaining the interstellar medium?
Certainly. The basic question is, what is the physical condition of the gas in the interstellar medium? And my thesis advisor, in fact, George Field, and a student and postdoc that he was working with back in the 1960s, explained the observational data on the atomic hydrogen that's observed in the interstellar medium with the two-phase model of the interstellar medium. And what they showed was that you could have this neutral gas could be either at a temperature around 100 degrees Kelvin, which is 100 degrees above absolute zero, or at a temperature of around 10,000 degrees. That's 100 times hotter, hotter than the surface of the sun. So you have these two possibilities, and the interesting thing is that those two very different temperatures, gas, could be in pressure equilibrium. So they could be, you could have them both coexisting at the same pressure. So this is analogous to phases, just like you were more used to having different phases. For example, when you have liquid water and steam, then at the very surface of the liquid water, the pressure is the same as it is in the steam above the water. So they had this two-phase model of the interstellar medium that explained some observations about the neutral atomic hydrogen. In collaboration with Jerry Ostreicher, who is at Princeton University, I then worked on some concepts which extended this and took into account observations that were made subsequent to the development of fields theory, in which we also explained the existence of large quantities of very hot gas in the interstellar medium. This gas, instead of just being at 100 degrees or even 10,000 degrees, was in a temperature of around 1,000,000 degrees. And this gas was produced by these supernova explosions that we were talking about just a few minutes ago. So when you have these titanic explosions, when the star blows up as a supernova, it drives very powerful shockwaves into this ambient medium, creating large bubbles of hot gas, which can be observed with X-ray satellites and other means. So in fact, prior to the work that Ostreicher and I did, Don Cox, who was then at the University of Wisconsin, developed a theory in which he pointed out that the supernovae were sufficiently common that they should occupy a significant fraction of the volume of the interstellar medium. Then what Ostreicher and I did was to take that idea, combine it with the idea that Field and his collaborators had, and then also take into account the fact that once you have this gas, you also have these stars that are trying to ionize the gas. And so you get 10,000 degree gas that instead of being neutral is actually an ionized plasma. And we put that all together and came up with three separate phases. We had the cold gas, warm gas, which could be either neutral or ionized, and hot gas, and was all basically at about the same pressure, which is why we referred to it as the three-phase model of the interstellar medium. We did not include in that theory the gas which is even colder and denser than the 100-degree gas, and that gas is molecular and is the gas out of which stars form. So at that time, we just put that aside, since we observation suggested and now theory confirms that that gas is generally at a higher pressure than the surrounding medium.
After your model was put out there and published, were there some major observations that came out that were used to confirm the model?
Well, I would say that there were certainly a number of observations which could be interpreted in terms of that model. The model, I would have to admit, though, was never finally either confirmed or not. One of the things that we conjectured was that the hot gas would tend to cause the colder gas to evaporate. So just like when you, going back to the example of the water, the hot water and the steam, that when the water is boiling, then you have the liquid water being converted into this hotter or less dense and hotter phase. Similarly, we thought that in this case, you have the cold gas and you put it in the hot gas, and this would then, the hot gas would cause the heat up the surface layers of the cold gas and cause it to evaporate. And that was very important in providing a self-consistent feedback loop that would regulate our model. And interestingly enough, although this process has been seen in observations of the sun, and there is some evidence for it in observations of the local interstellar medium, there is no conclusive evidence, I would say, that it is actually operating in the interstellar medium. So the one of the things which we assumed was that the supernovae that occurred were randomly distributed in the interstellar medium. And at almost about the same time we came out with our theory, it was pointed out by some other theorists that, in fact, they are often clustered together and that this can make a significant difference. I should say, of course, observers had known for a long time that the massive stars that exploded supernovae were clustered. So we had just made the very simplest approximation in the first version to ignore that. But actually including the effect of the clustering does make a significant difference in the observational implications of the theory.
Gotcha.
It did then provide a natural basis in which you could understand, in particular, some of the observations of this warm ionized gas that was seen. And it also provided direct observational accounting for the observations of the hot gas, which accumulated. We predicted that somewhat over half the volume of the interstellar medium in the galaxy was hot, and observations are not sufficiently accurate to pin it down to that degree of accuracy. Since our theory, in fact, I would say much more recently, people have been able to carry out large-scale numerical simulations. And most of these simulations do show the importance of the supernovae in producing this hot gas. But at least in the case of the galaxy, they tend to get a volume filling factor of this hot gas somewhat less than in the theory that we explained. But nonetheless, some of the basic conceptual ideas, I think, are still very useful in thinking about the interstellar medium.
I'm not sure if the size scale at which your three-phase model of the interstellar medium at which it applies would make dark matter relevant, but since dark matter has been discovered, though it's still quite elusive, what it actually is, but since it's a fairly more recent discovery. Does it play in at all? Does it? Do you have to rethink a little any aspects of the model?
The effects of dark matter in our model would be relatively minor, but we were trying to explain the interstellar medium of the Milky Way, which is a disk galaxy. Mm-hmm. So we're at a distance of some almost 30,000 light years away from the center of the galaxy. But if you then ask, well, if I go up out of the plane of the disk of the galaxy, then I would start the density of the gas would get much lower when I'm a few hundred light years above the disk, and it continues to go down even if you go out farther and farther. So the dark matter, however, is not distributed in a disk. Instead, it's much more spherically distributed. And if you ask, well, how much dark matter is there between the center of the disk of the galaxy and, say, this several hundred light years up above where the density has gone down, there's really not that much dark matter there. So it doesn't really have a very significant effect on the dynamics of the disk of the galaxy on the scale of the thickness of the disk. It is important in affecting the dynamics of the galaxy as a whole. So if you ask, well, the sun is moving around the center of the galaxy at a velocity of somewhat more than 200 kilometers per second. And if you took the dark matter away, then what would happen is that the force on the sun would be much less. So it would move out and would then be circling the galaxy, the center of the galaxy, much more slowly. But in terms of just the theory of the interstellar medium on the scale we were focused on, it's not the dark matter is not that important.
Your theory related to the interstellar medium was one of, I guess, the certainly one of the highlights of your career as an astrophysicist. How exactly did it affect your career since making that discovery?
As a result of that work, I think that is arguably the scientific work that I've done which has had the largest impact on astrophysics. One of the ways that people measure impact is by looking at the number of times your work is cited by others. And that paper has many more citations than any of the other papers that I have written. I then continued to investigate different aspects of that model in my subsequent work over the next couple of decades, in particular looking at the effects of the supernova remnants and how they expanded. And it was only starting at about, about 20 years ago, I then gradually started shifting my focus from these explosive phenomena, which underlay the three-phase model of the interstellar medium, to think about the collapsing phenomena, which are associated with the formation of stars.
Just in our concluding few minutes, I wanted to ask you about the topic of quasars, although we could do an entire interview on that, and hopefully one day we will. I know earlier in your career you were quite involved in research into the quasar phenomenon. Can you tell me a little bit about what your angle was on quasars?
So one of the works which I did in collaboration, I did two very interesting projects with Roger Blanford, who's now at Stanford University. So in the first one of these projects, we took the basic idea of a supernova explosion in which, as I've indicated, you have a star exploding and the gas can be ejected at a significant fraction of the speed of light. What Blanford and I considered was what would happen if instead of exploding at, say, 1% or a few percent of the speed of light, what if the explosion made gas go at almost the speed of light? So instead of 1% of the speed of light, say 1% less than the speed of light, or maybe a tenth of a percent less than the speed of light, so that it really was the expansion was almost at the speed of light, then all the effects of Einstein's theory of special relativity come to bear. At the time we were doing that, we were thinking of explosive phenomena that could occur in quasars, which at that time, we weren't quite so sure what they are. Now we know that quasars are basically phenomena associated with very massive black holes at the center of galaxies. However, it turned out years after we had done this work that the most direct observational application of the theory that we developed was for gamma ray bursts. And these are bursts that are believed to be associated with some supernova explosions. And there is direct evidence that there are motions involved which are close to the speed of light, and that you can use the theory that we developed, over 30 years ago to understand some aspects of those gamma ray bursts. Subsequently, Blanford and I worked on another aspect of quasars, and that was to try to understand how large they were. To what extent is it possible to figure out the size of a quasar and the way in which the matter in it is distributed? So I've already mentioned that it's believed that the quasars are associated with these very massive black holes at the center of galactic nuclei. And of course, it's not possible to directly observe a black hole. Nothing can leave a black hole. Instead, what we observe is the emission of radiation by gas as it falls into the black hole. And it's believed that there are very large regions that can be light years across that of gas, which is perhaps a disk that is rotating around the black hole and is gradually falling into the black hole. And then it's also observed that the emission from this disk varies in time. And what we showed was how you could use observations of the time variation of the light from the quasar to try to figure out how the gas was distributed around the quasar, and in particular, how large it is. And that approach is now one of the main approaches that people use to try to infer the mass of these massive black holes in quasars.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Christopher McKee, I want to thank you again for joining us here at the Star Spot. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for joining us at the Star Spot, mind and universe continually expanding.
The Star Spot with Justin Trottier is an astronomy and space-themed podcast based out of Toronto, Canada. Please send comments or questions to starspotpodcast@gmail.com. The Star Spot is produced by Ying Zhang Li, marketing and promotions by Natalie Morcos, guest news and voiceover by Amanda Gadke, research by Alexander Gurevich, web design by Blair Renault, graphics by Carmina Svillens. And I'm your host, Justin Trottier. Thank you for listening. welcome.